NPR's Throughline podcast sort of feels like stepping into a time machine. Each episode, our Peabody Award-winning show travels beyond the headlines to answer the question, how did we get here? Listen to one of Apple's favorite podcasts of 2024 by searching for Throughline on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.
After running into a wall in Washington, the president of Ukraine got a huge show of support from Europe. But Ukrainians are still very aware of one thing.
Without U.S. military support, it will be really, really difficult for Ukraine to withstand Russian aggression.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what's next for Ukraine? Also, a legal case against U.S. gun manufacturers is going to the Supreme Court. The plaintiff, Mexico.
The amount of gun violence principally committed with guns coming from the United States is enormous.
And lots of international winners at the Oscars, including a team of Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers.
It's not too late for life, for the living. There is no other way. Thank you.
All that and more today here on The World. Thank you for joining us today. In Europe, there's an effort underway to get a ceasefire in place for Ukraine. Britain and France are leading that effort. This follows what happened on Friday when President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance tried to humiliate Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House.
Over the weekend, Zelensky flew to London, where he met with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who gave the Ukrainian president a far warmer welcome than he got in Washington. I spoke with Maria Avdiva earlier today. She is a security analyst in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. I started by asking her what people there made of Zelensky's meeting in the Oval Office on Friday.
Well, people were shocked, absolutely, and they are still discussing it, like what has happened there. And a lot of people say that it was an ambush for President Zelensky. He was attacked, and a lot of people took it personally because Zelensky was there not like himself. He was representing Ukrainians over there, and he went there to sign an agreement, very important agreement for Ukraine and also for the U.S. So, like, accusing Zelensky that he doesn't want peace. This is not the case. This is not true. And This is why people took it personally and were really disappointed after what they have seen. But then after the meeting, the summit in London, the hope came back that there will be a possibility for the negotiation in the future that will bring peace closer.
Right. So President Zelensky's reception in the UK suggests that the British government wanted to put on a display of support for Zelensky after that disastrous visit to Washington. But what sort of concrete deliverables is Zelensky bringing back from that meeting with European leaders?
Well, first of all, the UK said that they are providing Ukraine with the big military aid package. And actually, what is important is that this money is going from the frozen Russian assets. And this is actually what Ukraine was always proposing, that there is no need to spend the budget money of the any country to help Ukraine defend itself from Russian aggression. There are billions of Russian frozen assets, and actually economic pressure on Russia is one of the steps that will bring peace closer. So such a large military aid package is from frozen Russian assets. This is something really very unprecedented. And also that UK put the biggest production of missiles for Ukraine and it will be produced in Britain. This is also one of the examples of how actually this is not only helping Ukraine to defend itself, but also boosting the industry and production inside the country.
Volodymyr Zelensky has enjoyed relatively high approval ratings throughout the war. Where do they stand right now?
The support rating for Zelensky is still, it's like 49% at the moment. So it's much bigger than anyone else who might be potentially participating in the presidential elections when they will be held. And actually what has happened in the White House and before, it leads to people unite in their support for Zelensky, because Zelensky is a wartime leader. And when such things, such a attacks happen and attacks on the country itself, on Ukraine. So people feel this urge to unite and support him because he is representing to his best possible way the interests of Ukrainian people.
Have you heard from any soldiers on the front lines since Friday's meeting with Zelensky and Trump? And if so, I'm curious to hear what their reaction might have been.
Yeah, I've actually met some soldiers just this Saturday. Like, they follow, of course, the news, but for them, they say nothing changes. They are worried about only one thing, if they will have enough shells and enough ammunition to defend their positions. So they continue defending the front line, and it's really huge, the front line in Ukraine, and they still need, you know, a lot of manpower and a lot of resources to defend it, and they are looking forward for the war to end. But they say, we want the peace to be lasting. We don't want to let Russia use this time, prepare, and then attack with greater power again in a very little time.
What is your sense of where Ukraine's diplomatic efforts to win support for the war and ultimately end the war go from here?
I think that Ukraine will try to get U.S. to the side of Ukraine in these negotiations, or at least, you know, to start communications on the higher level again, because U.S. is a strategic partner for Ukraine, and without U.S. military support, it will be really, really difficult for Ukraine to withstand Russian aggression. And there is a lot of concern among Ukrainians that it might end. Like, we have heard that there will be some announcement in the address of President Trump to the Congress. So people are concerned whether the U.S. military aid will continue coming to Ukraine, because that's vital. So I think that there will be efforts in the direction so that we have U.S. as an important partner who will support Ukraine and also support Ukraine militarily, because this is the way to deter further Russian aggression. Strong Ukraine means that Russia will be less likely to attack further and less likely to attack European countries after if they succeed in Ukraine.
Maria Avdiva is a Ukrainian security analyst. She joined us from Kyiv.
In a town about an hour away from London, there's a small business run by a father and daughter. They sell handmade rugs, both antique and modern ones, mainly from the Middle East. The story of this family business goes back decades to 1978, when a young Iranian moved to Britain to study engineering. Today, Thames Carpets is not just about making a profit. Its proprietors want to share stories about this ancient art form with a wider audience. The world's Shirin Jafari has more.
Sophie Javadi Babre grew up surrounded by carpets.
They honestly were like my brothers and sisters.
They were her playground, she says.
It's like they're colourful, the patterns and the touch of them. They were really enjoyable to be around.
Sophie's father has owned Thames Carpets since 2001. When she finished her studies in London, Sophie decided to go back home to help grow her dad's business. Before social media, Sophie's father would find out about auctions and clients through printed catalogues and word of mouth. But Sophie says she saw an opportunity to open up the business to a wider global audience.
These rugs were made by the Kashgari tribe in the southwest of Iran. They typically have reds and blues. They have that tribal rug energy.
5 years ago, she started posting on an Instagram page about the carpets.
These Kurdish rugs are woven by the Sanjabi tribe, and they're famous for having very sharp diagonal designs, which they achieve with a unique weaving technique.
In her videos, Sophie shares the stories behind each rug, where they're from, who wove them, and what the motifs and designs mean.
Whenever I talk about a rug now, I can look at where it was made, and then it leads me down this like this rabbit hole of finding out about the culture of where it was made, what the symbols mean. They're not just rugs. They carry huge references to cultural history.
The Tree of Life design symbolizes life, fertility, and growth.
Bahram was born inside a stable in a small village in northwestern Iran.
I'm Bahram Javadi Babre. and I'm 68 or 69 years old, but I don't know my exact date of birth.
He says at the time, birth certificates weren't issued immediately in his village. But he started weaving carpets when he was around 5 years old, and he hated it.
It was lots of pressure because I was so small. I was one of the fastest weavers. The yarn used to cut through our hands.
He could weave 60 knots per minute, he says. If he didn't finish the job on time, he would get punished. Bahram learned to read and write on the side, on breaks and at nights. One time, a client commissioned him to weave a carpet with the design of the ancient Persian city of Persepolis. It was tough, but he did it. The client was so happy with the result, he paid him generously. The money helped him go to school full-time. In 1978, Bahram went to the UK to study engineering, but his head was still in the world of rugs and carpets. He says he often got his hands on auction catalogs.
And I loved them, absolutely loved them. I mean, I used to look at the picture of them in the train. I used to miss my stop. Then I used to go, next one, come back, again, miss it.
Bahram connected with people in the industry through friends. One time, by chance, he was pulled into a challenging repair job.
Thames Carpets, there was one Isfahan Seyrafian. Isfahan Seyrafian writes the signature on the top of the carpet. They leveled it out and took the signature off. They tried to find somebody and weave that signature.
He managed to fix the rug, and the original owner of Thames Carpets brought him into the business. Eventually, he handed the business over to Bahram. Bahram's talent in repairing carpets has taken him to some interesting places, like Princess Diana's bedroom, where he fixed the Turkish rugs that needed repair, or the Duke of Wellington's home. He also restored the carpets at Windsor Castle after a fire in 1992 destroyed parts of the state.
I always say I'm the luckiest man in the world because the work I'm doing takes me to a different level of people.
Thames Carpets' Instagram page has about 84,000 followers. Sophie's posts tell the history and the art of handmade carpets, but they also capture the bond between a father and daughter as they run a business together.
It's cold in the rug shop.
Very cold. I'm going to fix it. Mate.
Sophie tells me so many people have reached out to her after seeing her Instagram page.
I've had quite a lot of people that are like a similar age to me saying that it's like helping them connect with their, if they have like a Middle Eastern background, but they were raised in a Western society, they've enjoyed learning more about that side of their heritage.
She says social media has helped her turn a somewhat niche craft into one that is more accessible. Each carpet tells a story, she says, of patience, culture, and craftsmanship. And she wants to share that with the world. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The British Parliament is famous for its raucous political debates, but last week the House of Commons rolled out the red carpet for a special guest named Owen Glass, who traveled to London from a long way away.
I'm going to introduce Owen, who's the youngest person ever to speak in this chamber, and he comes from the remotest place in the world, a part of the overseas territories known as Tristan da Cunha. Can we give a very warm welcome to him?
Tristan da Cunha is an island in the southern Atlantic Ocean. It sits about 1,700 miles west of Cape Town, South Africa. Here's Owen addressing members of the UK's Youth Parliament.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think I might be the youngest person who's ever delivered a speech in this amazing chamber. Well, I might be young, but like everyone here, I got dreams. And I know that education and training is how I make them come true.
He went on to talk about something many of us don't think about when we think about islands, what life is like in a place with such isolation.
Living on a remote island means we will know each other's business, but it also means great friendship and a strong community. We face challenges, but we find ways to overcome them, whether it's helping each other study, sharing resources, or just dreaming big about the future.
The Youth Parliament has more than 350 members from 11 to the age of 18. It was formed to give young people in Britain a voice in public affairs. They vote on their MYPs, or Members of Youth Parliament, every 2 years.
The Youth Parliament holds regular meetings, and that includes an annual debate in the House of Commons. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Oscars are billed as the biggest night in Hollywood, but last night's award show was very much an international affair. The World's Bianca Hillier is here to talk all about it. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Marco.
It was a very global Oscars. Which international films won big last night?
Well, I'll start with the cutest one. It's called Flow. It got Best Animated Feature Film. And this is the first film from Latvia to win an Oscar. It's about a black cat named Flo, who finds itself navigating a flood with a motley crew of other animals. And there's no dialogue in the film, but there are a lot of animal sounds.
Yeah, I mean, they're not talking, but boy, they are expressive.
Exactly. Matis Kaja, the film's co-writer and producer, told The World last month that all of those are real animal sounds, except one, the capybara.
We tried to record a real capybara at a zoo, but it was so high-pitched, the noise that it made, that it didn't really fit this calm, hippie-like character. So we ended up casting a baby camel to play the role of the capybara.
This hippie-like character, I love it. So the first Oscar ever for Latvia. Has this win a big deal in Latvia today?
It is. There is even a big statue of the cat in Riga right now. And then this morning on the news, some of the talk show hosts were wearing T-shirts with the cat Flo on them. So people are definitely really happy.
Yeah, not going to let this one get away so quickly. So that's Flo from Latvia. Then there is, of course, the award for Best International Feature Film. This year, that movie came from Brazil.
It did, and it's really exciting for them, too. It's a film called I'm Still Here. It's a heavy movie about a brutal period in Brazil's history, but there is this undeniable excitement and an energy around it across the country. It was Brazil's first win in the category, and the news came out during Carnival. So the MC at one of the main parades announced that Brazil won in the middle of the festivities.
Atenção, Sapucaí! Vencemos na categoria melhor filme internacional. Vamos comemorar. Parabéns.
He said, let's celebrate. And people did. They were jumping up and down and cheering.
I mean, the very fact that they took time to announce this in the middle of the pandemonium of Carnival speaks volumes. Just amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And a fun history tidbit here. The star of the movie, Fernanda Torres, her mom was actually the first Brazilian actress to be nominated for an Oscar in 1998. So it's just a real legendary family.
Yeah, that was Central Station. Great movie. Mm-hmm. Now, another category that often includes stories from around the world is Best Documentary. And this year was no exception, was it?
That's right. The award went to a film called No Other Land, and it chronicles the Israeli military's destruction of Masafer Yatta in the West Bank. It shows homes and schools being destroyed so the Israeli military could turn that area into a training zone. And the team behind the film is just as notable as the content, because it was made by a team of both Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers, including Yuval Abraham, an Israeli. He used his acceptance speech last night to call for a resolution that provides national rights for everyone.
Can't you see that we are intertwined? That my people can be truly safe if Basel's people are truly free and safe? There is another way.
Yeah, a profound moment in an otherwise mostly apolitical evening. How are Palestinians around the world reacting to that?
People are celebrating both the speech and the win itself because it is the first time a Palestinian filmmaker has won an Oscar. But many people here in the U.S. haven't even had a chance to see the film, Marco, because no U.S. studio agreed to distribute it. So it's only been shown at independent theaters and film festivals. Michael Maria is the programming director for the Boston Palestine Film Festival, which showed the movie in October. And he says he's both surprised and not surprised that No Other Land didn't get picked up by a U.S. studio.
There's a real general fear with programming Palestinian content. It takes real bravery and risk because there are many, many players out there who actively work to marginalize Palestinian artistic and cultural expression that humanizes Palestinians or that brings to light the cruelty and injustice of Israeli policies against Palestinians.
Maria does think, though, that this Oscar win will push U.S. studios to distribute the film, so we could be seeing that soon.
The World's Bianca Hillier filling us in on this year's Academy Awards, and what a great night it was for winners from around the globe. Bianca, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The trolley cars in the English seaside city of Brighton were thought to be lost forever. The entire fleet was dismantled bolt by bolt during World War II so the metal could be used for the war effort. But a group of volunteers found a sole survivor and have now brought it back to its original glory. The world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, has the unlikely story of Brighton Tram No. 53.
The year was 1939. The song In the Mood by Glenn Miller and his orchestra was topping charts around the world. And in Brighton, at the time a smaller, quieter town compared to the city today, a large fleet of electric trams was carrying thousands of people from home to work every day. But on September 3rd, everything changed.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street.
Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain made an announcement that would alter history.
This country is at war with Germany.
And bring the era of the Brighton tram to an end. England needed the wood and steel that they were made of.
The sad thing was they were burnt for the war effort and scrap.
Brighton resident Guy Hall has long been fascinated with the city's forgotten trams. He studied their history and, like the rest of the city, spent decades assuming they were all destroyed for the war in the 30s. But in 2009, he tracked down an old pig farm where he'd seen a picture taken of a trolley car that was eerily similar to Brighton's from the 1930s, a car with the number 53 painted on it.
When I first got there, I thought it would be a heap of wood, to be very frank, but it's actually in safeable condition, and that's what started the whole thing.
The tram was legit, a real double-decker car produced in 1937, and Hall, along with a group of volunteers around Brighton, launched what they call the Brighton Tram 53 Society. They began working on the restoration multiple days a week. Hall says his wife was supportive, but spending every minute of your free time on a tram can take its toll.
I was going out there one day, and my wife said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "The tram." She said, "Oh, that bloody tram."
Hall and his crew of locals spent 15 years on that bloody tram. They didn't make a cent off of it and relied entirely on donations to fund supplies. Hall says it's no surprise people around Brighton were into it.
It's a British obsession, you know. We like our industrial past. I think also, to be very honest, people think the past was better.
There's a whole community in the UK of people obsessed with old trolley cars. Just do a quick YouTube search.
Right, guys, welcome to episode 24 of Railcast Restorers. What you're going to see in this video is the gutter get painted, the tops of the windows get painted. And
you can find similar videos of Guy and his crew bringing Tram 53 back to life. It's not a 24-part series, but it's still worth checking out. They're now finished with the project and hope to actually get the tram running again. They've proposed a short track be laid in a community park and will make their pitch to Brighton City Council later this year. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
We've got plenty more stories from around the globe for you. Stay with us. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Mexico, they call it the Iron River, a reference to the steady flow of American-made firearms from the U.S. into the hands of criminal gangs in Mexico. Mexican officials have raised concerns about this for years, and tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case that places some of the blame for the gun violence in Mexico on American gun makers. Smith & Wesson Brands, Inc. versus Estados Unidos de Mexico, i.e. the Mexican government. It wants $10 billion in damages, and its lawyers will point out that Mexico is a country with tight restrictions on the sale of firearms. John Lindsay Poland is with an advocacy group called Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico. He's in Oakland, California.
At the heart of it is that it is predictable that the guns that are being marketed by U.S. gun companies are going to be trafficked over the border, used by criminal cartels in Mexico that accelerate forced migration, that feed the fentanyl trafficking into the United States and create enormous havoc within Mexican society.
And what sort of evidence will the Mexican government lawyers bring to the court tomorrow to prove this is a gun, this is a U.S. gunmaker problem?
Well, Mexico has already brought enormous amounts of evidence, most of which comes from the U.S. government. When guns are recovered in Mexico, about 25,000 are recovered every year. They're submitted for tracing by the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And consistently every year, 70% of those weapons are identified as being U.S. sourced. There's a whole other portion of the rest of the 30% that is of unidentified origin, which some of which probably come from the U.S. as well. And increasingly, there's a short time to crime between the purchase of the weapon in the United States and its recovery in Mexico. And that short time to crime indicates that the gun was purchased in order to traffic it. So Mexico has a lot of evidence about the gun companies actually marketing these weapons for Mexican users, sometimes even putting Mexican old war heroes' names onto the weapons, but also marketing weapons that have absolutely no legitimate use, even in the United States, like 50 caliber rifles that can fire over a mile away and bring down helicopters.
What about the other side of this case? What are lawyers for the gun makers going to be arguing?
They'll be arguing that there is no proximate cause between the sale of guns in the United States and in Mexico and the violence in Mexico. And they're saying, look, this is a legal product.
So I'm also wondering, like in 2023, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that social media companies are not legally responsible for something like an ISIS terrorist attack, even if the group posts on a site like Facebook. Couldn't you see this case as similar? Like, in other words, how can gun companies be responsible for what happens with weapons obtained by Mexican cartels? Do you think that'll also be an argument the Smith & Wesson lawyers will offer?
Oh, I'm sure the gun industry will offer those types of arguments. But I think if we think that there should be a line between what is an acceptable marketing of firearms, which are a lethal product, and unacceptable marketing of those firearms, then what are our criteria for drawing that line? And the consequences of that marketing should be part of that. The consequences occur in the United States all the time. We have a very, very high gun violence rate. But when you begin to include the consequences in Mexico as well, then there should be a line that puts a limit on that in order to protect both Mexico as well as all the consequences coming into this country.
Mexico, as I said, is seeking $10 billion in damages. Do you see that as a well-researched number in terms of damage and suffering, or is it really more symbolic than anything else?
The consequences for Mexican society have been enormous. I would say that $10 billion is on the low end of the actual consequences for Mexico. I also think that the most important thing that this case could do judicially is to change the practices by which the gun industry markets within the United States, which has enormous consequences within the United States, in Mexico, and in other countries as well, in the Caribbean and in Central America. It's also wreaking havoc.
John Lindsay Poland is with the advocacy group Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico.
This year marks half a century since the death of one of the 20th century's longest ruling dictators.
Españoles, Franco ha muerto.
Francisco Franco, the Spanish general, was laid to rest in a mausoleum of his own design called the Valley of the Fallen outside Madrid. Franco's death in 1975 ended a long and painful chapter of authoritarian rule in Spain. To this day, he is a controversial figure. The country's current socialist government has launched a year-long celebration of the dictator's demise called Spain in Freedom. But not all Spaniards are on board. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from the village of Belchite in Spain's northeast.
The original village of Belchite is gone, most of it anyway.
This town was utterly destroyed during the Spanish Civil War. What I'm looking at is a field of shelled brick homes as part of a church with no roof, piles of rubble, wooden beams, green growth pushing up through the cracks and the holes in the walls.
The whole thing's fenced off. To go inside, you pay a guide who will tell you about how when Spain's Civil War ended in 1939, General Franco decided to leave these ruins in place as a monument, he said, to the atrocities committed by his enemies on the left. Franco had a new Belchite built right next door. A local retiree, Miguel Ángel Saavedra, is out for a walk there on a recent morning. He tells me he hopes what's left of the old Belchite lasts forever, along with Franco's memory. Franco saved us from the communists, he says. Under the general, we had 50 years of peace. As long as there's one decent Spaniard still standing, he says, I hope Franco will never be forgotten. That's a decidedly conservative position in today's democratic Spain, but Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez agrees that Franco's memory should be kept alive. Not because he's a fan, but because of how terrible he says he was for the country. His decades in power were marked by violence, oppression, and international isolation. Speaking at the kickoff event of Spain in Freedom in January, Sanchez said he worries Spain's youngest aren't aware of that.
Cuando uno ha pasado toda su vida bajo su velo protector, es fácil olvidar.
When generations have lived their entire lives under the protective mantle of democracy, Sanchez said, it's easy to take it for granted. And even in exchange for your personal freedom, he said, it's also easy to be seduced by people who promise order and security. In other words, far-right extremists. Nativist political parties are gaining followers across Europe, from here to Italy to Germany. Sanchez hopes to counter this rightward drift by hosting this year of events. It's meant to warn against fascism, but also to celebrate just how far Spain has come socially, economically, and politically since Franco died.
En su recorrido por la zona regable del canal de Cacín, a 15 kilómetros de Granada, Franco se detiene en el nuevo pueblo de Fuensanta, donde el prelado de la diócesis.
In his heyday, Franco controlled just about everything, including the media. His regime made these weekly newsreels, shown in movie houses. In this one, you see Franco inaugurating a new town. People look happy to see him. You couldn't say the same for his political enemies. Franco kept hundreds of thousands of them in concentration camps and prisons until long after the Civil War. When Franco died, a sense of freedom infused large parts of the society, especially young people. In Madrid, an explosion of creativity spawned La Movida, a wave of high-voltage pop bands still popular today. Songs were laced with criticisms of society, the sort of stuff that could have landed you in jail under the general. In 78, Spain held free elections for the first time in decades. Robert Fishman is a professor of political science and sociology at the Carlos III University in Madrid. He says today, by nearly every measure, Spain's democracy is healthy.
There's a lot of diversity and vitality in the news media. That's important. There are a lot of organizations that people are strongly engaged in. When people are unhappy with the government, and often they are, they feel free to protest and they're able to do so.
But today's healthy democracy came in exchange for amnesty back in 1977. Amnesty that included Franco's henchmen and torturers during his years in power.
Por ser auténtica, no mira hacia atrás, sino que fervientemente.
Center-right politicians like Rafael Arias negotiated what became known as the Pact of Forgetting. For this to be a true transition to democracy, he said in a speech in Spain's Congress, we must not look backwards. We must transcend the differences, he said, that overpowered us.
The Pact of Forgetting was probably necessary in 1977, and it is no longer so.
Again, historian Robert Fishman.
In civil society itself, people have refused to continue forgetting. It's very difficult. There are many, many Spanish families who lost many members of their family to the violence, the imprisonment, the repression of the Franco regime. There were many thousands of people killed.
Under Franco, it was illegal for relatives of the vanquished to search for and rebury their dead. But under laws passed by Socialist Party governments, people can now exhume mass graves scattered around the country, like this victims group was doing at a battle site along the Ebro River last year, led by archaeologist Oscar Escala.
También una parte importante es devolver los muertos a las familias que realmente los buscan.
One important part of our work is returning the dead to the families who've been searching, he told me, standing alongside a trench filled with human bones. It really touches your heart, he said, when you realize that what you're doing has meaning. Fallen soldiers and civilians aren't the only remains being disinterred of late. In 2019, a newly elected Pedro Sanchez had Franco himself exhumed and banished from the Valley of the Fallen, that resting place for nationalist heroes the general himself had ordered built.
Viva España! Viva!
A handful of the late dictator's relatives carried his coffin to a waiting hearse, then shouted, "Long live Spain, long live Franco." A lot of Spaniards were upset by his exhumation, including Alberto Feijó. He's the head of the center-right Popular Party. They can dig up Franco 100 times, he said. The left remains mired in the nostalgia of conflict from long ago. Meanwhile, we're focused on building a brighter future. There are monuments to the past, however, that Spanish conservatives do want to keep, like the ruins of the village of Belchite. In 1936, Franco's nationalists executed hundreds of men and women in cold blood there. Leftist Republican forces retook the village in 1937, killing lots of Franco soldiers. During the battle, shells reduced the place to rubble. So who's it a monument to? To madmen of all stripes, says Maria Martinez, a barista in a cafe in the new Belchite. During the Civil War, my great-grandmother was sentenced to death by firing squad, she tells me, twice. Once by Franco soldiers at the outset, then by the other side, she says, when the Republicans retook the town. Both times, she says, her great-grandmother had rifles pointed at her head, but she was spared after being recognized by firing squad commanders. For me, Martinez says, Belchite is a symbol of the horror and the limitless cruelty of humans. It's what happens, she says, when ideologies are taken to the extreme. We shouldn't forget what happened in Belchite, Martinez says, but we shouldn't use it for political gains either. For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon, Belchite, Spain.
In Iran, Parliament voted on Sunday to dismiss the country's economy minister. He was selected by Masoud Pezeshkian, who took over as Iran's president in July. Since then, the Iranian currency, the rial, has lost about 60% of its value. Iran is also subject to something like 5,000 different economic sanctions. Many are related to its nuclear program. Today, an advisor to President Pezeshkian, who was an architect of the 2015 nuclear deal, was also fired. Barbara Slavin is a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center and an expert on Iran.
The U.S. dollar is now worth almost a million Iranian rials. And just to put that in perspective, when I started going to Iran back in the 1990s, a dollar got you 10,000 rials.
Wow.
On the black market. If you go back to the days when Iran and the U.S. were in a nuclear agreement together, I think the rial was about 300,000 to the dollar. So it has just been a precipitous drop. And I've always worried about the impact on ordinary people. People cannot get insulin. People cannot get all sorts of medications, or if they are available, the price is astronomical. Ordinary people are suffering. They're cutting out all but bare essentials. And I just feel very sorry for 80 million people who are going through all of this. Firing the finance minister is not going to solve it.
Will anything change due to that change?
I really don't see it unless there is some sort of breakthrough in talks with the United States, and that also doesn't look very likely right now. We see that the Trump administration is much more focused on Ukraine, to a lesser extent perhaps on keeping some sort of ceasefire going in Gaza and in Lebanon, and Iran doesn't seem to be a priority for Donald Trump. He seems content to let Iran basically twist in the wind.
Mm-hmm. So if sanctions are, you know, one of the drivers of the plummeting rial, hammering out a new nuclear deal would help. But the architect of the 2015 deal, Javad Zarif, was asked to resign today as well. What is going on there?
Well, this is a long-time rivalry between Zarif, who is connected to the reform factions in Iran, the factions that argue that Iran cannot rely solely on China and Russia, but needs some sort of relationship with the West. And more hardline factions that have dominated Iran, frankly, over the last 40 years, but particularly the last 10, 15 years. And so, you know, going after Zarif is one way of making it even more difficult for Iran and the United States to reach some sort of agreement, because Zarif is not only fluent in English, he went to university in the United States, got his PhD here, served as ambassador at the United Nations. The argument against him is that his children were born in the United States when he was a student here, which is hardly something that one can blame him for. But the 2022 law that was passed by the Iranian parliament bars individuals with strong ties of some sort to the West from being senior officials.
Hmm. Why does it continue to be so important to Iran's hardliners to keep advancing the nuclear program?
Well, it's pretty much the only leverage that Iran has left. Iran has been steadily amassing more and more enriched uranium. And just today, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency said that Iran has now 275 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60% purity. That's very close to weapons grade. Iran could further enrich this material to 90% and would theoretically have the ability to put together a half dozen nuclear weapons. So this is Iran's only leverage, it seems now, with the West. And I think the expectation in Tehran is that at some point the United States will want to have talks with Iran, will come to Iran with an offer. But Trump has yet to appoint an envoy to deal with Iran. As I mentioned, he seems content to increase sanctions and increase pressure on Iran. So who will blink first?
Barbara Slavin is a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center and an expert on Iran.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The dreaded job search, it's stressful no matter who you are, but it's especially hard for immigrants who earn their college and graduate degrees abroad. Hundreds of thousands of people fit that profile across the U.S. Trajan Warren from GBH has this story about efforts to help immigrants in Massachusetts start and, in many cases, restart their careers.
Frederick Rochaka walks into the dimly lit basement of the Rhino Lounge in Waltham to prepare for his night shift.
When I come in here, like today, I'm going to set up the music. It starts playing. I go in the bar, check it out, see if everything that is meant to be there is there.
The lounge has been his main source of income since immigrating from Uganda in 2022. He has a bachelor's and master's degree from the largest university in Uganda. But this Ugandan-owned restaurant lounge was the best job he could find in the Boston area. Meaningful career opportunities didn't present themselves to Rochaka when he first got to America.
Moving and reestablishing in the United States is not an easy thing, most especially for immigrants. Because when you come here, like I've told you, with the highest level of education that I had acquired as a master's degree, I couldn't get a job that required a master's here.
He is one of 240,000 immigrants in Massachusetts with a foreign college degree. That's according to a 2023 report from Tufts University and the Massachusetts Business Roundtable. Many of them earn less than people with similar degrees from American schools. The report says residents with a foreign bachelor's degree would earn an additional $2.3 billion more a year if they were paid the same as U.S.-educated workers. J.D. Chesloff is the CEO of the Massachusetts Business Roundtable. He says that the state has a strong need for skilled workers.
And we have this really wonderful pool of untapped talent here, people who are educated in a foreign country but can't access the workforce. And so I think it's essential for our current and future economy to figure out how to get immigrants connected to work opportunities, both to the benefit of them and the employer and the state's economy.
African Bridge Network is one organization helping connect the state's top employers to this workforce. Its executive director, Emmanuel Owusu, said the organization has helped over 350 people so far.
We provide them the adequate and the accurate information to allow them to begin to figure out how do I build career in Massachusetts. So the way we do this, we organize what we call orientation workshops for skilled immigrants.
Kimberly Adolph is one of the people ABN has helped. Through the ABN Fellowship, she was paired with Boston Medical Center as a clinical researcher. She came to the U.S. from Haiti and found the adjustment overwhelming until she was connected with ABN.
For someone coming in a place that who doesn't know really anything about the place, so ABN is like water in the desert.
Rochaka also was paired with Boston Medical Center through an ABN fellowship. He said that he's hopeful it will lead to a job beyond the Rhino Lounge.
Every immigrant has their own story, and each story is unique, and some are amazing, most especially how you find ourselves to get settled in here.
And getting settled means finding not just a job, but a job that will match the skills they were trained for back home. For The World, I'm Trajan Warren, Boston.
When you're on a road trip, a convenience store has just about anything you need. Turns out the ubiquitous mini-mart is also there for you even when you're walking through the Korean countryside.
We'd be out walking through rice paddies or over wooded mountains, aiming for what next, of course? The next convenience store.
That's National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. He's been walking the path of ancient human migration since 2013, and we caught up with him last week to talk about his journey through South Korea.
South Korea is, as I understand it, kind of the world capital of convenience stores. It has more than 55,000 of them. So they're everywhere.
And so tell me, when I think convenience store, I think of like hot dogs, sad hot dogs on those metal rollers to keep them hot. But when you stop in South Korea at a convenience store, what have you mostly been eating or what are the offerings?
Everybody gets their favorite item, right? Me and my walking partner. I kind of fell into an egg salad sandwich, iced coffee combo.
Okay.
And all the food is actually quite fresh. It's amazing.
So what else is on offer there? Give us the menu.
The variety of things is astonishing. They have like 98% of all the material culture of the planet. It's like, you need computer cables? They got computer cables. You need socks? They've got socks. You need medical supplies? They've got medical supplies. But they also have quite a range of foods, from kind of the unhealthy, the usual junk food, to very healthy foods, freshly daily made salads with six different kinds of dressings, rice balls, even tofu.
So after all your walking, how did these places compare to other places that you stop for food and drink on the go elsewhere in your travels?
You know, walking out of Africa over the last 12 years, I mostly did not stop at convenience stores, right? I was, you know, eating in people's homes, which is wonderful. I'm stopping at open bazaars and street markets where street food is delicious and you get to have a conversation, you know, with a stranger. Convenience stores don't quite live up to that kind of a human interaction, but the ones in Asia are a different beast altogether than the ones, say, in North America. The ones in North America are often associated with food deserts. The food that they sell is often very unhealthy. But the convenience stores, as I mentioned earlier, in South Korea were a marvel of kind of multitasking, not just food, not just other products, but they served as mail centers to deliver and pick up mail. They had banking centers, multi-purpose.
So, Paul, I know you read a lot, you think about history a lot. I'm wondering if you can kind of situate convenience stores in this history of places where travelers would stop back through time.
You know, it must go back to the end of nomadism and the beginning of agriculture, the beginning of kind of towns and cities where merchants and travelers would kind of have a place to go, usually probably an open market space. Imagine an alleyway with cobbled lanes and there were hawkers selling whatever was fresh and available from the farms. That model is probably ancient. And in some parts of the world, like China, you still find it.
Mm.
Silk Road times, these caravanserais, these caravan stops in the deserts of Central Asia that I walked through were walled kind of fortresses against raiders. But inside you had almost everything you needed. You had forage for your animals. You had a fountain to wash in and to wash your clothes in. You had a balcony that would catch a breeze. You'd have a hookah to puff on, and of course you would have food. So these kind of comforts that were proffered to travelers are very old. And every time I step into a 7-Eleven in South Korea, I kind of do a little bow to this legacy of travelers' comforts along a very long trail through the centuries.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. Check out photos and stories from Paul's walk through South Korea. They are at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.